Should be very pleased to have Tom here. So he's got a lot of things on fingers in pies. So there's bioscience, biophysics, but also the wider questions of science and society and how religion fits in. Research to do with that polymer chemistry, but also the education group of the Royal Society, of which he's FRS, obviously. And most recently, the medieval history of science. So I think it's lovely to welcome someone so Renaissance man, as it were. I think it's just lovely to see people being whole people in that way. I'll just open with a quick prayer then. So, Lord, thank you very much for this time together, and help us to open our minds and also our hearts, so that we can have an understanding of you which fits with the understanding of your world. Amen.
And thank you for having me. It's great to be in Bristol. Again, I love visiting here. I've spent the afternoon in the mathematics department. Thank you, Carl, who's not able to be here this evening, but it was great to talk about some protein folding and some studies of the mathematics of evolution with some mathematicians this afternoon. Of course, Bristol is a wonderful place to be visiting as a physicist, with its tremendous history, particularly perhaps around Paul Dirac, and I always feel happy here. And also, actually, this was the town in which I attended my first ever scientific conference as a research student. I remember sitting on a wall and being looked after, academically that is, or corrected politely by a very wise and kind Italian master of the field of polymer rheology, that's flow of sticky plastic. So this is always a very special time, so thank you for having me back. So I'm going to talk for about 45, 50 minutes, is that okay? And then we'll do some questions, is that right? On this title, Faith and Wisdom and Science, which is also the title of a book. I'll try not to mention that too much, but Christina's already said that at enormous expense, I have made sure that it's not my wisdom, by the way, I'm talking about, you understand, it's God's wisdom. Okay? So you're not buying my wisdom. So there we are. And there is a new book, which I'll say now, I also might mention later, just out, and that's a 10% discount, which is the message you're going to hear, but packaged for, particularly for broader readership than university people, and particularly school pupils, called Let There Be Science, which I've co-written, thankfully. You'll be glad about that. The guy who really did the writing is a wonderful school teacher called Dave Hutchins, who is also a youth pastor at his church near York. So he really drafted the book, and he tells science with stories. One consequence of that is David has more young women doing physics A-level in his school than young men. He's cracked it. That's enough of a plug for that, but there'll be another plug later. So those are the plugs. Let me do the prejudices. So this is where I'm coming from, and this is not going to be an apologetic talk. It's going to be a talk about the neediness of science and about what the church or the body of Christ can give science, and through giving to science can give society. This is the way I put it. Science has lost its plot. Science needs what I call a deep cultural narrative. What do I mean by that? I've always loved science since I was very little, and I've always understood science to be one of the great humanities, in a way. I would talk about science in the same breath that I would talk about music, or drama, or great stories, or literature, or art, or raising children and families, or building community. It's one of those great things that humans are gifted to do. But if you think about it, if you agree with me, in our current media world, or in educational world, we don't think of science like that. We think of the Big Bang Theory program, where it's the people who don't do the science that are the people you want to spend time with and have meals with. You don't want to spend time with those geeky, weird people. Or think of the Today program. Much as we're proud of BBC 4, Radio 4's tradition of erudite analysis, have you noticed the different way in which John Timpson handles science or scientist to the way you'd handle a politician or a poet or an artist. It's completely different. There's a sort of, oh, you wouldn't really want to get interested in this, but we'll let the scientist tell us a few things we won't understand. And then we'll shut him up quickly, and it's usually him. It's true, isn't it? It's really great. And there's a problem. There's a problem. One of the problems is that we've been made to think that science, one of the reasons we don't think science is deeply humanist, all those other things, is because we framed this as exclusively modern. You know the words of Alexander Pope. The world was bound in deepest night, God said, let Newton be, and all was light. But that's not how it went. But we all swallow that history of story. That's the history of science that I was taught. That before 1600, it was all dogmatically, theologically, small-minded, blinkered teaching, and then suddenly science opened a secular window of light onto this Dark Age world. Well, no historian of science would ever uphold that narrative, and yet, according to recent surveys, as I'm sure you know, 60% or more of our 15 and 16-year-old children, including those at Church of England schools, believe that science is in direct conflict with religion. This current perception that science is just simply modern, and no one ever talks about science before that, I think is a harm in many ways. It impoverishes well-being. I just imagine a world, I did actually, the introduction to Faith and Wisdom in Science, I set myself the task of imagining a world, just to drum it home to myself and others, in which we'd done to music what we've done to science. In this world, no one goes to listen to jazz clubs, no one goes to listen to symphony orchestras, or string quartets, or pop groups for that matter. Oh no, that would be far too difficult for common people. They happen, of course, but they happen in musical laboratories, where experts listen, okay? And then the next morning, the Today programme, we might get whistled the tune. But harmony and counterpoint would be far too difficult. It's horrific, but that is what we've done. We've not shared. So it polishes people's well-being. This is the key, well, one of the key issues. It paralyzes the public debate. Think about those important science or engineering or technology-based questions which weigh on us in our current day. From little ones, from fracking, huge ones like genetic medicine, the whole issue of climate change. Think of the rather impoverished quality or lack of quality of our public debate. It's not really adult, is it? People have their preconceived opinions and they chuck them at each other. We don't really move on. And for me, for my money, this is a far more important indicator of that there is a problem with science and faith or science and religion than the noisy sideshow, which is Richard Dawkins versus the creationists and those stuff. I just think that's, I know I'm being a bit provocative here, you may want to ask some questions about that, but that's what I think. And primarily this loss of the deep human history of science distorts the relation of science and religion. We're going to explore that a bit. Today's what I want to do. I want to say that a lot of what we currently frame as the science religion debate is the wrong place to look for the science religion debate. What I mean is those stormy arguments between you know, six-day creationism and Richard Dawkins saying that you have to be stupid to be a Christian. Right? That's this conflict narrative, and I never thought that I would be grateful to Donald Trump's communications secretary, but Kellyanne Conway has given us the language for this narrative that science is in conflict with the religion. It is now officially an alternative fact. true, isn't it? Now we know what it is. Hooray, call it out. Here's something else. Have you noticed that the science and religion discussion or debate isn't characterized by very much Bible study? It's strange, isn't it? You'd imagine that a serious bit of Christian theology would do that, but it doesn't. Where it does, it tends to orbit rather mercurially, doesn't it, around the first chapter of Genesis. Now, don't take me wrong. I'm not saying the first chapter of Genesis isn't a wonderful, important text. It is. But just because it's the left-hand end of the biblical shelf, I'm sure everyone here knows that the Bible is a library, not a book, yeah, and that we share different sections are shelved at different points. Yeah. The oldest stuff isn't necessarily at the left-hand end. The oldest stuff is, in fact, probably in the wisdom literature, which is the middle bit of the Old Testament. Right? So what I'm going to suggest is that where we start with thinking about biblical foundational material to get us thinking about what is science within God's kingdom, then we want to start with the wisdom literature, and in particular, lock the doors. No one's getting out of here until you and I have been together. You did look, didn't you? to the book of Job. It's a warning, because that's where I think it all starts. I think we should think about the science. I think we should reflect on more areas of science than we normally do. Because, you know, nothing wrong with this, everything right. You should have evenings on evolution and quantum weirdness and cosmology. But what about statistical mechanics? What about the complexity of materials and the study of chaos? We're going to look at Job, and we're going to see quite a lot of the problem of chaos there reflected in ancient language. And perhaps the final thing I want to say is what I want to try and do in my manifesto. I sometimes put it this way. It says, obviously something is wrong with the theology and science debate. And for about 10 years, I thought that the problem was probably with the theology. Right? You know, it's just not up to the task. It's ancient and science is modern. It's old thinking. We've got to have new thinking. It's pouring new wine into old wineskins. And then I started reading some theology and talking with theologians, and I learned how wrong I was. Of course, these are among the most scholarly and well-read and well-thought and philosophical of people, that theology is not an ancient discipline. It is, but it's also a modern discipline. No, theology does work for us, and wonderful work. Okay, it's not the theology. Maybe it's the science. It's obviously the science then. It's people like Richard Dawkins. It's people like Peter Atkins. It's the people who push scientism. And this view that all this logical positivistic view that the only thinking worth thinking is scientific thinking. Right? Well, there are such people, but I'm sure you also know they are the minority of the scientific population. Most scientists are naturally humbled by our extraordinary. A couple of us were having a conversation at the back there about what Eugene Wigner called the extraordinary unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics to discover the world. Einstein said, the most inexplicable thing about the universe is that it's explicable. Why should we be able to do this? To think about the inner structure of an atom, to conceive the way that signals are processed by DNA inside cells, and what's going on? It's quite wonderful. It's humbling. So it's not that. Then I realized the problem is the and. It's the and. Of course, you don't notice the problems with the and because it's such a little word. But it does terrible damage. Suppose I'd come here and say we're going to have a debate about black and white, about rich and poor, about the East and the West, about the North and the First World and the Third World, do you see what I mean? The and sets the boundaries. It frames an oppositional or a dualistic, antagonistic debate. It's a bit like at our school's children's school playground. Towards the end of every summer, there's a chap using a bloke on a little tractor goes around painting white lines on the fields, and the rugby pitch, he paints a white line down the middle of the field, and that white line is the and. Is the and the right conjunction? I'm going to suppose that it isn't. I'm going to suggest that we ask a different question. Rather than ask the question of the relationship between theology and science, I want to ask what the theology of science is. So if you've come here hoping for another take on how to resolve the conflict between theology or belief and science, you're going to be very disappointed, because I think, the reason is, I don't think that is even a well-posed question. I put the, can you resolve, reconcile science and theology sounds now to me like the have you stopped beating your wife yet question. Well, yeah, no, yes, no, wait, no, don't ask me that question. It's the wrong question. It simply assumes the wrong world. Can you reconcile science and religion makes assumptions about the world that are alternative facts. So, friends, brothers, sisters, we're going to allow ourselves 40 minutes of luxury. We're going to just breathe a sigh of relief and get off that back foot of apologetics and ask the question, which if only we had time to ask, would be the delicious question that would allow us to move forward, that all Christians have to ask about whatever they do, which is, God's given me a gift. Perhaps it's singing. Perhaps it's teaching children. Perhaps it's making wonderful pastries. Perhaps it's speaking Serbo-Croat. Perhaps it's doing physics. What's it for? That's what I mean by the theology of something. When you ask what's the theology of something, then you're asking what in God's kingdom, within the story, God's great story of creation, fall, election, incarnation, crucifixion, resurrection, mission, new creation, within that great big story, what is science doing? What's it for? That's the question I want to ask. And you know, you think about it, why haven't we asked this before? Well, you have, but not so much. When we do that, I think we can loop back to the beginning and we can start to reappraise science within a Christian worldview as God's gift, as a sanctified thing, culturally, anthropologically, theologically. And if that's true, you see, the church can adopt a new stance to science rather than having seen it as we have for over a century now. Only of a century, seen science as a threat to belief. We can start to appreciate it as God's gift to engage in the world his commission. Right, so we need some clues. How are we going to, how are we going to sniff around? We're going to do some Bible work, but where do we do? What question do we ask next? So here are a few clues. I want to go to this this political debate story. So here's an example. It was a nice project, a fascinating project that was run out of Durham by some colleagues of mine in geography and social science around the nanotechnology debate. It's one of those awkward political debates around new science. Remember, do you remember it was a few years ago, about 10 or 15 years ago, perhaps a bit longer, and people were saying that all these nanotechnologies are very dangerous. They were going to make Franken drugs and Franken foods and Franken bits of humans, and they were very dangerous new molecules. And so, well, let's just see. I think Prince Charles once weighed in and said that we should shut these laboratories down because grey goo would self-replicate and emerge from the scientists' laboratories and envelop us all. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. Great respect for Prince Charles, wouldn't, don't you? But perhaps he didn't make the most constructive contribution to the debate at that point. No, interesting how I look at the fear. Now, what these social sciences did was to look at the public media debates, the focus groups, the written submissions from NGOs, and ask, okay, now what these people are talking about is hazard and risk, technological hazard and risk. But that's because the government insists that you have to frame your debates that way. The point is that people tell other stories when they are worried about what science is doing or technology might do, right? And they want to tell those other stories. So what they did was a narrative analysis, and they found that underneath the debates that were ostensibly all about risk were other stories, you know, just those stories, ancient narratives, what they call narratives of despair, the be careful what you wish for narrative. You don't know what might come out and bite you. The opening Pandora's box. Do you remember the Greek myth? It's the just-so story of all the troubles. Pandora, daughter of Zeus, and a human, she was given this casket, actually it's probably a pot, and she was told not to take the lid off, but she did, and out come all the troubles, and once all the troubles are out in the world, you can't get them back in again. That's Pandora's myth. Don't mess with nature. Nature is sacred. We touch nature, mess it up, we suffer the consequences. Those are the ancient myths, two modern ones. The people in technological power will keep you in the dark, and the Marxist narrative, the rich will get richer and the poor get poorer. And the philosopher Jean-Pierre Dupri was part of the team, and he said, these are the common myths, they've been around for centuries, if not more. Think of what you mean for the myth of desire, the Pandora's box, the narrative of evil, nature, the narrative of the sacred, being kept in the dark, being the narrative of alienation, and the rich get rich, poor get exploitation. So these were like, I sometimes like to think, these are the hidden sharks swimming under the surface. You don't see them, but they dominate, they cause the ripples of debate. And I've since involved some of these people and others on another project on GMOs, genetic modified organisms and their adoption in Brazil and Mexico and India. It was a fascinating project. But around the, again, tortured and intransigent sort of debates were these same stories. Now, Have you noticed something? They're all negative, they're all dark, they're all despairing, and they're all pagan. There's not one of those deep stories driving or lubricating or supporting this debate which has anything to do with Christian thinking whatsoever. Why is that? Well, if you didn't need any more evidence that the church has turned around and run as fast as it can in the other direction, sort of subject, has buried this talent in the ground, in spite of the fact that the master is coming back to find out what we've done with it, I don't think you need any more evidence. Oh, it's all gone a bit quiet in here, hasn't it? Right. What about this myth of alienation? I remember the day I read this line from a book, a wonderful book, which you haven't read, I do recommend it, George Steiner's Real Presences. George Steiner, wonderful European man of letters. I think he held four European chairs at one simultaneously at one point, one in America. Post-Holocaust, atheist, Jewish, obviously. You'd forgive any Jew after the war, after the Nazis, for being an atheist, wouldn't you? And it's an extraordinary book, though, for many reasons. I won't have time to go into all of them now. One reason is he calls on Christian imagery all the time, to describe what it's like being a human being. But at one point, he's discussing the purpose of art. And so my eyebrows go up, you see, because I'm interested in people who discuss the deep purpose of things. As a posh word is teleology. And I remember the first time I read this sentence, only art, he says, can go some way towards making accessible, towards waking into some measure of communicability, the sheer inhuman otherness of matter. Now, I wonder what you imagine I thought when I first read that sentence. I'm thinking two things very quickly. The first was, aha, yes, this is part of the human predicament. We are made of the stuff, we're in the stuff, but we don't feel comfortable with the world in space and time. C.S. Lewis once commented this in regard to time, didn't he? He said, time, it's weird, we're like fish out of water, except we're in the water. Time is always runs too quickly for us or too slowly. It's never just right. Well, why is that? We're made in this. Why are we one step broken from the world? Here's Steiner saying we're one step broken from the material world. There's a broken relationship that needs reconciliation. And he says that's what art is for. By doing art, we heal, we somehow work our way back into the world. Well, that may be true, but only art, George, Professor Steiner, only art? Surely, if science does anything, it does this. It makes accessible, it opens a communication between us and inhuman matter. We start to remodel, recreate inhuman matter in our minds, with our experiments. That's what science does. So, of course, this might also tell us about how science and art might be seen as two sides of the same coin, but that's perhaps for question time. Okay, aren't they? Here's a third clue as to about where to look. So we've got relationships, we've got narratives and story. What about a name? Where does science come from, and why is it a name that people find uncomfortable, or scientist? Why do I say scientist, and you shut your eyes, what do you think? I know what you think. You think white coats, clipboards, then you do. You said it. It's okay, you do. Or you know, Sheldon Cooper. God help us. Right. Okay. Why do you think that? I'll tell you why you think that. Because even whether we know Latin or Greek or not, we are all aware of somehow, I don't know how this works, language works in wonderful ways, of the history of words. We know that scientist comes from the Latin scio, sciere, I know. It's a knowledge claim. And it comes from the Roman world. Stand to attention, centurion, and march north. Yeah, it's that world. But 200 years ago, even 150 years ago, I wouldn't be called a scientist. Or Alan wouldn't be called a scientist. Those people who come from science, you wouldn't be called a scientist. You wouldn't be called a scientist. What would we be called? Natural philosophers. Very good. You don't need me here. So science says, I know. Natural philosophy says, philosophia. It's Greek, I love wisdom. So try this out on your friends that don't like science. Say, okay, forget the science. Suppose I asked you instead whether you'd be interested in the love of wisdom to do with natural things. Would that be more interesting? Would you like to be involved in the love of wisdom to do with natural things? Ooh, that I've seen people smile. I've seen people's eyes start shining at this point. And I love that, because we've lost our way somewhere. The 19th century really got it badly wrong. The 19th century is when natural philosophy became science. It's when the single discipline started, single idea started splitting into a million disciplines, and it's when the conflict narrative was invented. Okay. So what about the Bible and science then? Well, look, what do we look for? We now know better than to try and look up science in the concordance, don't we? Because it's not going to be that. I mean, this is silly, isn't it? But you know, it's not going to be there in the Bible. But if science has to do with our relational engagement with the natural world in wisdom, okay, so we drilled down a bit there. We've got then we can start looking for biblical texts about a relational engagement in wisdom with the natural world. Now the Bible opens up a huge volume of richness for us. Hope you like the microwave background there and creation stories. And the one place does is the creation stories. Now, not so by the by, I've lost count of how many creation stories there are in the Bible. This isn't about, you know, I'm not going to talk so much about creation as in our interaction with it, but, you know, there are creation stories when you have an eye to see them everywhere you look. Proverbs, Psalms, other Psalms, Psalm 33, Psalm 104. Isaiah tells creation stories all the time. He tells a wonderful creation story at the beginning of Second Isaiah, when the handle comes in with the tenor solo, and the mountains will be made plain and all that. Isaiah 45, Jeremiah 10 tells a creation story. Actually, Jeremiah, by the time you get to Jeremiah, Jeremiah knows that he knows everyone will be alert to a creation story. So when he tells the creation story, he puts the film in backwards and runs the creation backwards and says, Israel, if you don't disobey, this is what's going to happen. And the whole creation dissolves into chaos again. It's very powerful stuff. Hosea chapter 2 is a lovely creation story in Hosea. And it goes on. John chapter 1, by the way, the great prologue to John's gospel, I hope you know it, is a creation story. Deliberately, it's in the beginning, in Archaea to Logos, in the beginning was the word. John is deliberately echoing Genesis chapter 1 there, obviously. And so, yeah, creation, I love the fact that creation stories are told over and over again. Now, and some of them are very short. So you'll find that the basic Hebrew creation story is over in one or two verses. It says something like this. It says, for the Lord created the heavens and the earth. He separated the waters from the dry land and the skies above from the foundations of the deep. Done. That's it. It's all about a separation. It's a shaping. It's a sculpting. It's a potter and the clay and a creating of boundaries. Now, of course, you think about it, that's exactly what Genesis 1 does, but it starts there and it decorates, it adds very important things. Creation stories. Let's just go to one, the birth of wisdom. So wisdom is personified in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 8. Do you remember, some of you will know this thing, the Lord's brought me forth, and she speaks, wisdom speaks as a female character. As a little girl, actually, almost, as the first of his works, before his deeds of old, I was appointed from eternity. You don't have to read all this, but it's lovely. See, if we just read down here, we're halfway down. I was there when he set the heavens in place. He marked out the horizon on the face of the deep. He established the clouds above and fixed securely the foundations of the deep. He gave the sea its boundary so the waters would not overstep his command and marked out the foundations of the earth. That's the creation story. And then I was the craftsman at his side, filled with delight, day by day, rejoicing. You can just imagine, I think of my little daughter in a sandpit on the beach when I read this, making castles and little rivers and things. And this is right at the beginning of things. And we have wisdom as the creating wisdom. So, you know, we could spend all night, couldn't we, going through the wisdom literature and some of those other creation stories. I mean, incidentally, I find this little, why did I tell you there were 35 creation stories before you even lose count? Just in case you're ever in a position of helping people, dear people who get hung up after reading one page of the Bible, that this is the creation story and this is the way it had to be. You see, what I want to say to those people is I'm not asking you to believe your Bibles less. I'm asking you to believe your Bibles more. I want you to read more of it. I want you to read all the creation stories and think about all of them. Here's another one. And this is the text that I find astonishes my non-believing or even believing scientist friends, if not with them for the first time. Job 38 to 40 is the Lord's answer to Job. So we're going to cheat. We're going to skip for the moment right over those 37 chapters. I'm sure I won't ask you. I'm sure you've all read the book of Job, as you have the whole Bible from beginning to end. But it is quite hard work first time you do it, isn't it? All those speeches and cycles and arguments, and Job defending himself and his friends, saying, "Oh, something's gone wrong here." And then God finally speaks. He answers Job's complaints. Job is railing at God that he's suffering unjustly. He's not unjust. He's righteous. Why did this happen to me? It's a very common story, isn't it? His three friends around him, and they, for 3 days, they do the wise thing and they sit there in silence. And then on the fourth day, they do something terribly stupid. They open their mouths and try to say something. Anyway, questions. God answers with questions. What sort of questions? Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea? Where is the way to the abode of light? From whose womb comes the ice? Where does ice come from? What is hail? Do you know the laws of the heavens? He says. And can you apply them to the earth? What an extraordinary question. What a cosmological question. At one point, he says, look at the Pleiades. You know, the little seven sisters, the star constellation. Why are they all clustered together? Whereas the stars of Orion are all scattered. It's a really interesting question. How does the hawk navigate to the south? Where does the rock badger go in the mountains, the wild donkey to lay her young? It's just wonderful. It's nature's wild, unknown sides. There are 168 questions. It's a poem in which every stanza is a question. I think it's the most extraordinary nature poem of all history. And one of the reasons that saw scientists get so excited about it when I point them out, and often, I'll tell you when this happens at science conferences. You know, the scientists here. I love telling people outside the world of science that in the bar after the conference dinner, you know, in Kansas City or Boston or Kyoto or wherever you happen to be, you know, science, the money is awful, but the travel's fabulous. You get talking. And one, you know, 50% of the time, scientists are deep thinking people. They start about deep things, and you can talk about religion and God and deep meaning. And I love saying, look, has anyone here, by the way, read the most beautiful nature poem ever written? What do you mean? It's in the book of Job in the Bible. It can't be in the Bible. What are you talking about? Yes, it is. Look, go back to your hotel room tonight, and thanks to the Gideons, I know that the one book of ancient literature that they're all going to find, wherever we are in the world, more or less, open the Bible, bang the middle, turn right a bit, and you'll get there. Job 28, 38, have a look. Tell me what you think at breakfast time. They're amazed, wondered, delighted. Why? Why? Because here's a thing. And it has to do with education as well. You know, we tell or we imply to our young people when they're learning science that the way to be a great scientist is to be good at finding the right answer, don't we? I say this to my aspirant PhD, my new PhD students. They come to me all bushy-tailed and bright-eyed at the beginning of a great, you know, we hope, scientific research career, and I say, I've got some really bad news for you. You're here because you've been fabulous at finding the right answer in the back of the book or in the examiner's crib sheet or something for the last goodness knows how many years. But from now on, that skill is going to be almost completely useless to you. And what you, because we don't know the questions yet, what your job is to think about the imaginative question. Because the key creative step in science is not the answer, it's asking the right question. Because when you've asked the right question in the right way, as Heisenberg and Einstein and just about everyone has said, and it's been my experience as well, that unlocks the way to the answer. So finding a nature poem from the ancient world cast in the form of these creative questions that open up the fields of science we now call astronomy and meteorology and geology and zoology and all these things is an extraordinary thing. What's it doing there? This makes us want to look at the book of Job. Okay, look at the book of Job. Right. Now, I have to say, one way of talking about this, try and keep those mentions. It's a sort of scientist commentary on the book of Job. It hangs on Job. I think that's so important. And you don't have to believe me. Believe David Clines, now retired professor of Old Testament at the University of Sheffield. David has just finished, or had just finished, or was finishing, when I was thinking about this, the third of his monumental doorstops of the book of Job. This is a man who spent his life, he's the world's leading Job scholar, he has spent his life in the presence of this book. It's just fantastic. Look, that's what he says about it. And you know, you might think that if you spend your life with a text, your whole academic life, you might get a little bit dulled down. But he said to me quietly, and he writes it in volume 3, when God speaks from the whirlwind, I don't know how many times he's read chapter 38, verse 1, he says a little frisson goes down the back of his neck every single time. Isn't that wonderful? That the Bible is so fresh to a scholar who's made that book. Anyway, so Clines calls this the most intense book intellectually and theologically of the Old Testament. If he says that, who are we to disagree? So there's a bit of structure there for you. It's introductory narrative. We haven't got time to go through all this, but this is a bizarre structure to this book, to the opening page, and then the speech cycle starts, and Job speaks, and Eliphaz and Job, and Bildad and Zophar and Job, and then the cycle happens again, and there's a third cycle. And then partly because the text is getting so angry and the arguments are going nowhere and people are getting bitter, the structure of the book sort of reflects it. It starts breaking down. The third cycle doesn't complete. And then this Elihu speaks up. And where's he come from? It's just, you know, this new friend who's there all the time. Or was he or not? And then the Lord finally answers. And after the third cycle is this vital hymn to wisdom. Now, the Lord's answer, which we saw a bit before, has come in for a bad press in the scholarly literature. It's come for a bad press for a number of ways. So the interpretation that I'm going to discuss with you this evening is not the canonical standard one. So warning there. It's not the canonical one, but I want to advance it, and I'm not the only one who advances it. It's a secondary, it's a minor interpretation. The classic interpretation goes something like this. Why does God question Job? Job is complaining that God has behaved unjustly, has been a bad God, that nature is punishing Job and it shouldn't be. Why me? God finally speaks up and says, well, Job, you're so clever. Where does the hail come from? Do you know where light comes from? What about the lightning? Can you guide the lightning? Have you ever commanded the day to dawn? You don't know much, do you? In fact, you don't know anything, do you? So why don't you just shut up? Okay, I paraphrase, but that's, you know, it's said in theological language. But as John Roberts said, this is not Yahweh, this is a put-down, petulant deity who just wants Job to shut up. Now, is that really what's going on? Okay, so that's the first reason this is given. The second critical reason that the Lord's answer is an inappropriate answer to Job's question is because it's got nothing to do with Job's argument. Job's arguing that there's a moral issue with the universe, that he's suffering when he shouldn't be suffering, that there's a justice issue, the whole thing is legally framed, he wants to answer God in court. And God asked Job a lot of tomfool questions about stars and rivers and jackasses and hail. Okay, what's that got to do with it? I'll tell you what it's got to do with it. What it's got to do with it is that if you look carefully, you don't have to read that carefully, you just have to read the first 37 chapters with an open eye to the natural world. The book of Job is saturated with nature from beginning to end. There's not a chapter that goes past without tree roots or rocks or a flooded wadi, or a cloud, or all the clouds. It's extraordinary. People can miss this. What is more, there is a pattern to this. Remember I said that the structure of the book echoes the escalating cycle of embittering arguments? The cosmology and the nature poetry does as well. The first speech cycle is predominantly decorated by metaphors around inanimate nature, the earth, the wind, stone, sea, brown stuff. The second cycle goes animate. It's the plants, the vines, milk. And it's only when the gloves come off and the accusations, which start off being, yeah, Job, think about it, a good man is blessed by nature. If a man were to sin, he would suffer. Not talking about any particular man, just hypothetically. Shame your suffering. You know, that's you know, cycle one. Cycle three is you, Job, have sinned. Repent. I mean, they're getting really angry because their brittle worldviews are being threatened all the time and they cannot cope. At that point, we are treated to the great, very rare exposure of Hebrew cosmology. The entire canopy of the cosmos is opened. So you can do this. You can take, as I say in the book, so you can take a nature trail through this wonderful book. And you know, it starts with nature. There's Job's suffering, fire, wind. Job's materiality gets at him. He's covered in grievous sores. It's disgusting, it's pustulant stuff. He's afflicted by nature without and within. Now, I didn't tell you quite, I should have done, all those creation narratives, there's actually a pattern by which and in which and when the ancient Hebrews tell a creation story. They tell a creation story when Israel is in a position of desperation, has lost the plot, is feeling destitute and lost, can see a distant hope, but can't see how to get there. Go and check it out if you don't think it's true. That's when they tell a creation story. Psalm 33 tells a perfect example of this. Here's another one, but you'll find in Job all the regular Hebrew motifs are twisted and turned upside down. So just at the point at where you expect Job to tell a creation story, he tells an anti-creation story. Would that the curses of days had laid a spell on it. He's talking about the day of his creation. Would that the stars of its dawn had been darkened and never seen the eyelids of his morning. He wants to uncreate his own day of creation. Oh, and by the way, here's the first mention of Leviathan, who will frolic for us in chapter 42. So the Job, by the way, I've put in just to lighten this up a little bit for you, William Blake's wonderful coloured engravings that illustrate the book of Job. Blake was passionately inspired by Job, both an artist and a poet. So this is classical of hope and hopelessness. Now, not all the bad stuff is given to the friends, and not all the good stuff is given to Job. Sometimes little rays of hope are given to Job's friends. Here's Eliphaz responding to Job in the first cycle. Remember the stones. This is the first cycle, earth. He's talking about when Job will repent and be healed. Halfway through, for you will be in that day in covenant with the stones of the field, he said, and the wild animals will be at peace with you. What do you think about that? Does that shock you? It should do. What's shocking about that? Covenant with a stone. You can't have a covenant with a stone. That's practically blasphemous. A covenant is the highest possible relationship. It's the kingly relationship. And it is, of course, the godly relationship. It's the Abrahamic and Mosaic relationship with Yahweh. That's the covenant buried. And this is buried. The Hebrew is the same Hebrew. In spite of that, you'll find that many translations have bottled out at this point. They refuse to use the word covenant because you can't have a covenant with a stone. It's ridiculous. Or can you? What about this reconciliation of the sheer inhuman otherness of matter? What about this rendering and communicability to make friends with our world again? I just wonder, echoes of Hosea chapter 2 here. But then, you know, you have these little windows of hope and then the mountain slips away and erodes and the cliff is dislodged for its place. This is Job accusing God. You destroy man's hope in the same way that the cliff erodes over the centuries. Just entropy gets you in the end. And like I said, the third cycle, just showed up for you, there's Blake's picture, the topmost stars. But just look, by the way, this twistedness, what's going on? We have the whole of the Hebrew canopy of space here, the thick, but look, and God is veiled with clouds. But again, can you see how twisted the veiling is? God is often veiled with clouds isn't he, in theophany, in Hebrew appearances of God. Why? It's so that we are not blinded by the radiance, by the intolerable radiance of the deity, isn't it? But here, thick clouds veil him, and he cannot see as he goes on his way with the waters of heaven. God is himself blinded. He's like the clouds are blindfold for him. That's ridiculous. But do you see how twisted and out of tune this whole thing has become? And then we get the cosmology. He stretched out the north over chaos, suspended the earth from nothing, wrapped up waters in clouds, and covered the site of his home. He's got this, we can see the earth suspended there in the cosmos. And why are we at the heavens? We are at the heavens because the arguments have escalated, the accusations have got higher and higher, and the impenetrable accusation has met the irresolute defense, and we're going nowhere. So what do we do? Well, what the book does, what the writer of the book does, is an extraordinary move. We need a new voice here. And I'm reminded by, you know, I used to be a great fan of Alistair Cook. Do you remember Alistair Cook's letter from America? Most of it happened when I was very little, but I tended to catch the, when I grew up, he was almost finished, and I caught the kind of golfing stories he had towards the end of his life. But I do remember one extraordinary letter from America. I think it was at the time of the first Gulf War, he was talking about, do you remember the debate of in the Congress, would the hawks win or the doves win? There was always talking about hawks and doves. And he'd met one wise old senator who said, "Well, Mr. Cook, what you should understand is the issue not really is whether we have too many or too few hawks or doves. The issue is that we have a lamentable shortage of owls." It's cool, isn't it? So, at this point, we have gone a search for wisdom. That's what happens. This book is a gorgeous book. And we go to a peculiar place. At this point, when the arguments have got nowhere, we're taken down a mine. Anyone remember this? Job 28, it's called the Hymn to Wisdom. "Surely there's a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined." It's serious mining technology. Look, iron is taken from the rock that we poured out as copper. It's about smelting, and it's about what the miner sees. Read on, "An end is put to darkness," because they have lamp in their hat, "and to the furthest bound they seek the ore in gloom and deep darkness. A foreign race," because it's a dangerous job. It's what you hire the immigrants for, right? "Cuts the shaft, forgotten by travelers, far away from humans, they dangle and sway on the end of their rope. But can you see what the miners see? The earth from which food comes forth is underneath, changed as if by fire. Its rocks are the source of lapis with its flecks of gold." Now, why are we gone down a mine? We don't know what's going on at first. But then what the writer does is to muse that only human eyes, one thing that makes humans special is only they see the structure, the deep structure of the earth from inside. They actually said not even the falcon with her sharp eyes sees the seams of gold, the precious stones from underneath. No, that's a particularly human ability. And then this chapter goes on a search for wisdom. And is it to be found in the depths of the sea? No, it's not. Is it in the depths of the mountains? No, it's not there. Is it in the marketplace where we go to the economy? And it's a rather amusing and opulent text. There are six different Hebrew words for gold used as we go through the marketplace, visiting the various stalls, and ask whether wisdom is there, and it's not. And then finally, actually, this is the first time God almost speaks, or we heard about God. God understands the way to it, "for it is he who knows its place, for he looked to the ends of the earth and beheld everything under the heavens, so as to assign a weight to the wind and determine the waters by measure." Look what God is doing. Why does God know the way to wisdom? Because he also looks into his creation with sort of x-ray eyes, beholding everything, not just the surface, into the depth. And to be quantitative about it, the wind has a weight and the waters have a measure. God is doing, at the end of the search to wisdom, what the miners do at the beginning, the humble miners. Now, the other reason I'm delighted to share this particular passage with you is because although it may be new to the people of Southwest England, it is not news to County Durham miners. All County Durham miners know this. They call it the Miners' Prayer. It's paraded in the streets in the Miners' Gala in Durham every year, and it's on a stained glass window in Easington Colliery Parish Church. Why? Because this is where the Bible celebrates miners and mining. And it becomes an icon. You see, it becomes an icon for what's specially human. And for me, this is my favourite icon. For some, we were having this discussion before about what science is. And I think science, and I'm not the only one to say this, my elevator pitch for science is that combination of sight and thought uniquely gifted to us that enables us not to just see the perceived outside superficial nature of things, but to go into their centres and ask about the structure of atoms and the swirling mists of galaxies and the far distant echoes of the initial first moments of the cosmos at the beginning of time. There it is. So, can you see, when we get to the Lord's answer, the Lord is answering not just Job, but also the hymn to wisdom. Have you done this and journeyed with me to the deepest and further expanses of the world? Questions are only asked in the Bible to teach. The great Hebrew pedagogy. When God asks Adam, where are you? Is it because he doesn't know where Adam is? Of course not. It's because he wants Adam to think. If you've ever been to a Hebrew Passover, you'll know that it's the little children who have the questions. Why these bitter herbs? Why this funny wine? You know, it's questions, questions, questions. It's always to teach. But look what he says. He begins to say about the chaos. Who cuts a channel for the torrent of rain, a path for the thunderbolt? Bring rain on land uninhabited. The reason that God asked Job thinky questions about the wild and chaotic side of nature is because he wants Job to think about how you create a world and endow it with freedom to explore all its possibilities. In the same way, you create a human being endowed with freedom to love you back or to go its own way. So there's something deeply common about the donation of freedom to creation as a whole and the donation of freedom to us. And God is, as if God is saying to Job, look, yes, I can give you the nice ordered creation you want. If you like, it'll be as ordered as a crystal. It'll be as still and predictable as a stone. And it'll be every bit as lifeless. So Job's accusation that God is as out of control as morality as he is of nature is appropriately challenged by God saying, think about why nature might be a bit out of control. It's a challenge to this simplistic encoding of morality in nature. Can you send the lightning bolts on their way? Can you channel them? So, interestingly, in taking a step back from this book of Job, we find in Job and his four friends now, and in God, various different ways of looking at nature. There is this brittle moral, that nature is there to enshrine retributive moral law. Right? That's what Job's friends think. One of them, Elihu, thinks, no, it's eternal mystery, you'll never understand nature. Zophar actually says, Job, at one point, you should read nature. It's a book, it'll tell you, let's tell you that you're a bad boy and you should do better things. Job's accusation is that it's uncontrolled. At one point, actually, Yahweh asks, he thinks himself, am I suffering because I have been led into nature worship? Now, those are five ways of looking at nature. And do you remember, we noticed in our own time, five ancient stories whirling around our public discussions of how we engage with nature. And there they are. They're still there in Job. They're all there in Job. They've been there from the beginning of time. Eternal mystery, alienation, retributive moral law. Nature exploits you. The book of nature, it's just a sacred thing. Nature is uncontrolled chaos. It's evil. The object of worship, it's this narrative desire. We have our five impoverished pagan myths that we desperately need to supplement with a Christian, positive, light-filled story that can meet in our own time these very practical political discussions at their own level. And there's a sixth one in the wisdom literature that engaging with nature, with our minds and our hearts and our intellects and our husbandry is the way to wisdom. It's the way to wisdom. Now that's the story that I'd love to think with you, think through with you about how we disseminate. Now, of course, before we wind up, we should do what every Christian theologian should do. We spend a lot of time in the Old Testament, not enough, but enough for us, right? Because we're getting to an end, aren't we? Just a few more minutes. But we also want to just check any theology we do from the Old Testament, we need to take through a New Testament lens. Okay? Now, you might think, well, there's not much creation in the creation stuff in the New Testament, is there? But once you've become alert to the intense theological engagement of the wisdom tradition in the Old Testament, of course it's picked up in the New, because Jesus and Paul and Peter and all the others were saturated in this stuff. It was their text, particularly this reconciliation motive. And I love what St. Paul does in the Corinthian correspondence when he has to summarize what the Christian way is all about. Therefore, it's about a new creation, he says. So he tells the creation story. It's a new creation. It's the new, all this has come to God. And then he says what this creation is. Christ gave us the ministry of reconciliation. I love that. We're in the business, he says, of healing broken relationships. I think he'd be the best master of the soundbite, the Today program. Let's visit again. Suppose St. Paul went to be by the Today program. St. Paul, would you just tell us, the listeners, we've only got 2 minutes, we're reaching the 9 o'clock news, but some people tell us that you're just atheists, some people tell us that you're perverse Jews, some people tell us you're political disruptors. What are you all about? And what does Paul do? He's got 30 seconds left now to tell John Tinsom what Christianity, what this funny new movement is. And he said, I know what he's going to say. I know exactly what he'd say. You know, he's not got time to tell a story about Jesus. He's not got a time to remind us about the Abrahamic covenant. He says, John, I'll tell you what we're doing. We're the business of healing broken relationships. Oh, well, that sounds interesting. I could use some of that. And it's brilliant. We could all. But God was reconciling the world to himself. That word is cosmos. It's a cosmic thing. And of course, again in Paul, we're still in Paul here, in the great passage of the Romans. Now, Romans 8 is a great bridge passage. It takes us from there's now no condemnation, at last, that's the beginning of Romans 8, remember? Yeah. To the end of Romans 8, where we want to go to. We know there's no condemnation, but we haven't got to the place we want to be, which will, nothing will separate us from the love of God. Neither sin, nor pain, nor death, nor anything will separate us from the love of God. How does Paul get from getting over condemnation to eternal presence of God? He tells a creation story. All creation groans until the children of God are revealed. Yeah? Or enter into the glory of the freedom of the children of God. The creation has to have the freedom that it only has when we are in right relationships with it. Of course, Jim Dunn, St. John's College, Durham, I have to quote a Durham theologian to finish with, don't I? But well, look what he says. An out-of-sortness, a disjointedness about the created order which makes it a suitable habitation for man at odds with his creator. He wrote that a long time ago. He would say people at odds with his creator now, I'm sure. So here we have a go. This is what we've got to. You can tweet this. This is my start of a 10, and it's your job to critique it in question time. A theology of science. This is what I think, if we bring all those strands together to give us a starting point to work out what we now do within the kingdom of God, science, let me have a go, see what you think. The participative, we engage with it, relational. It's co-creative, we're working in the image of God, working with creation, within the kingdom of God, of healing the fallen relationship of humans with nature. It's got some wonderful consequences. It picks up, remember what I said? It picks up this long history of the relationship between the human and the non-human. It has a really high view of this human aptitude to reimagine nature, to do science, as a cultural activity. It brings not just knowledge with it, but wisdom too. It's got this dual structure. Remember the owls, not enough owls. It brings the owls. It actually affirms, because of the context of pain, that engaging with nature isn't going to be easy. It's by the sweat of our brow. It's the thorns. It's the childbirth. It's all those things. It's ambiguous and painful, but it is our call. And sometimes healing relationships is itself painful. You've sometimes got to go through the pain to get to the healing, and it's no different to our engaging with nature. It'll recognize this extraordinary, beautiful balance of order and chaos. It affirms this underpinning wonderful world of chaos I talked about right at the beginning. It does so much for us. It celebrates the creative question. We're quite bad as Christians sometimes, aren't we, living with questions. We find them awkward. We'd like answers all the time because answers are safe. But sometimes it's not time for the answers. And Job had to wait for millennia before some of those answers came. But living with a creative question. And here's a surprising thing. We don't often put the word science and love together. Although I do remember Brian Cox once saying on his programmes, "Oh, I do love science." One of the moments. I remember that because it's one of the few times you hear love and science right next to each other. So how can we, what are the consequences after? Well, here's some things to start questions going. I thought when I started this project that I might get to a place of a rather conservative conclusion. I thought I might be saying there are no-go areas, but you can probably see that I've taken us and myself to a rather different place, where because we are made as God's co-agents, able to make nature fruitful and to understand it and to change it and to work with it as all relationships work and mature and grow, there are no a priori areas that we don't touch. That doesn't mean that anything goes. That means we think carefully and biblically and theologically about anything we are about to do. But we don't say, oh no, immediately without even thinking. It suggests that just like it is with Job, our thought relationship with nature might be therapeutic. Now here's a wild thought. Some people who are hurt or in pain are healed through art therapy, aren't they? Or drama therapy, or music therapy. I have a very good friend who's a music therapist. It's wonderful what music will do. What about some areas of hurtfulness that might be healed by something we would call science therapy? Oh, no, that's what made me go bonkers in the first place, I hear you say. No, I mean, not going to do that. But I don't mean doing a GCSE in physics. I mean the sort of playful engaging with science. I had a lovely conversation just a couple of weeks ago at the Royal Society with Andrea Wolfe. Andrea Wolfe is the author of a beautiful book called about Humboldt. And she won the Royal Society's Science Literature Prize this year. And I talked with her, and I'm reading the book now. It's a lovely book about this extraordinary 18th century scientist. And I said, who are you looking forward to telling you about this reward? It's a bit like the Oscars. You have a short list of four, and an envelope is opened, and they will read a bit from their book, and then we find out who's won. And she said, I want to tell my old chemistry teacher from school, who's still just alive. Why? Because she told me when I was 13 years old that I would never be any good at science. I would never understand a word. And I want to go to her and say, Royal Society Prize! And then she said a lovely thing. She said, it's great. She said, because this book, by the way, has real science. It is a biography of Humboldt, but to read this, she's got to get her mind around the science. It's a wonderful book about science. And she said, science is like a palace with many doors, but we only ever show children one of them. And I couldn't go through that door, didn't have the key. But I found another door. Do you see what I mean? That's what I think we can do with this. We can show people other doors to enter the palace of science. We could do lots more healing. Look, I mean, the two cultures. I mean, just think about, we talked about Art Steiner. I passionately think that a Christian mind in the university is one that doesn't fragment disciplines, but that helps disciplines to live together. This we've got to do. We've got to get some of these deep underlying narratives in maybe a secular form or salt them out into the secular world because they're desperately needed there because this absence is causing some of these log jams. There's wonderful ideas for interfaith dialogue. Actually here. There's not one faith in the world that doesn't have an issue with science. And when talking, or at least opening up channels to talk about faith with other religions, it's far easier to talk about something which concerns us mutually than to just talk about our differences. Let's face together. Let's face a problem and share it together. I've talked with some Muslims about this, and there's some real traction. The science and the media. You see how some of these deeply human stories can help a media that thinks the humanities are fun and the sciences are dull. But if the science is a sort of humanity and carries this deep theological story, maybe there's something we can do there as well. And as I said before, the church can celebrate the great
humanity of science. I did say about this book at the beginning, here's the front cover of Let There Be Science, and my heart is so out for the school pupils. For some reason, whether it's the teachers or the pupils, most of them think that there's been this lifelong antagonism between theology or religious belief and science. It's just not true. We've got to get that message across. And Dave has a wonderful way of telling it. And if you've got someone who's stuck and says to you that my teacher says that science and religion won't go together, this, I think, unpacks and takes this story further and shows far from it. In fact, you know, the theology that I wish I could say I've invented, I haven't. The theology I've talked to you with tonight is not new. It's the theology that the philosopher of early modern science, Francis Bacon, wrote into his texts, Novum Organum, that got modern science going. Early modern experimental science was launched as a Christian theological project as a response to the consequences of the fall. It's not in the history book. But it is in the primary text, so there you go. Told through stories, data, physics teacher, and you don't have to make a choice between Christian faith and science. That's the message of this one. Oh, and along the way, we put in Mr. Spock, Monty Python's Black Knight. You'll meet a levitating frog, and more and more. So it's not quite so heavy as what we've just been through. But I wanted to give us the underpinning, the foundations, right, for all this. So look. Let's stop with as Durham Cathedral gazes over us, and I've gone on too long, but thank you for your patience and your engagement. Science is at the heart and part of Christian worldview. The roots are old. It's a part of our calling to heal. Science and faith are of each other, and we, the church, need to get up and answer this call to leadership and voice. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Wow. Thank you very much indeed, Tom. It's such an expansive and I think in a sense novel, which shouldn't be novel, but it is where
it is and isn't, yeah.
The topic. I reckon we have more scripture from an FRS physicist than we often get from the pulpit.
Aha.
I don't know what that says about you or just before I open up to questions, you were talking about school children, and there's a big project, which you'll be aware of, called God and the Big Bang.
Yes, absolutely.
Where scientists are going into, Christian scientists are going into schools. Mm. And we always do a survey before the event and a survey afterwards. Mm. And normally it is about 80% of the people beforehand, the pupils, believe that you can't be a scientist or a Christian. 80%. By the time they've heard scientists who are Christians talking about their science and their faith, it comes to 20% because of this misunderstanding. Mm.
That's all,
but
yeah.
I'll just throw that in. And it's a really wonderful project.
It's a wonderful project. And if anyone's here to do with schools, then do get in touch with Michael Harvey. I'm sure you
Well, there was one in the cathedral a couple of weeks ago, so it's happening. But it is very exciting. Anyway, open to questions. Anybody? Tina's got a microphone there, so
mic.
Anybody's got a question, put your hand up. Oh dear. There we are, there's one.
You talked about the five negatives that have been around for a long time. Yeah. And when you put the last slide up, you had six on one side and five on the other. I just wondered what you'd put as the last one on the bottom of that.
Yeah, I know. Please. There we are. Yes, exactly.
So it would just be wisdom carried
the
forward.
The way to wisdom is the missing sixth. So what we've got to do, what our job is the ones on the right are the deep stories that are running around our world now, preventing us getting moving on with genetic medicine or climate change or nuclear fusion or whatever it might be. When people get stuck, and more. I mean, I think they're also the narratives that are driving this alternative truth thing. So it's worse has happened now. Science is now pushed into an optional thing. It's optional. If you don't like the evidence that scientific methods produce and you're a politician, you can just say, well, no, they don't like it. You'll invent something else. And that's because of a combination of the narratives of evil and desire. And it were alienation. There's no contact. If there's no contact between us and the world, then the stuff we find out about the world is just another story. So these five dark narratives are doing a lot of damage. Now, let me just explain. What science is trying to do at the moment is to confront them with technical scientific evidence. Okay. But you see, that comes in at a different level. The reason it doesn't make contact is because these are stories that are swimming along at this unseen depth. And we're trying to meet them with this technology here, but evidence, but you know, measures of temperature range. But what are you talking about? We're not combating the motivational stories. I'm not saying we drop the evidence. It's very important to work at the level of data. But we need to work at the level of story as well. So what we have to do is to add to that list the Christian story that you tell about science. And that, I'm indicating, is the missing bit on the right, is the version for today of the way to wisdom that we saw in Job 28. Does that help?
Thank you. Yes, right. So you just put wisdom across.
Pull wisdom across. And what we've got to think about is, how do you pull wisdom across? How do you talk about the way to wisdom of deep engagement with the world that says, actually, this is positive and a gift and something like singing and heart, art and all that is good. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very inspirational talk. And I'm very much in accord with you in talking about science as a humanity. Right. And engaging people in questions rather than answers.
Yes,
and all this
lovely
sort of stuff. What I'm really interested in is where you've had a great list of things, but where we go from here. All the talk you've been given, the Book of Job and all this stuff, is unknown territory to most people. The language of religion, of Christianity, is unknown to many people.
Yes.
And how do you have this book, and I'm interested to know what sorts of things you've put into that. But is that going to go into the box called religious education in schools, or is it going to go into the box of science schools?
Right.
And when the scientists try to get involved, as your colleague Michael Rice did some time ago, you have huge fury from some of the science community.
Okay.
So how do we go from here?
Right, yep, great question. So one thing is, Dave and I made absolutely sure that we had as many people reading this and giving reviews and blurbs on it who were atheists as believers. So it is not a book for, and positive ones. Sarah Thompson, who is head of physics at York, who's Dave's former head of department, he did physics at York, wrote a positive, the communications officer of the Royal Observatory has written a blurb, and there have been several other. Now, obviously, they're not the scientists, they're not the atheists who are vigorously anti-religion, but then nonetheless, they are secular scientists. So we wanted to write a book to try exactly this. So what we've been trying to do is, can we start telling a story that, although it is deeply Christian, is just what a secular scientist, when they read it, it's like fresh water. It's the story they need to tell that supports science, that gets their science out there in a more sort of lubricated way. And, well, all I can say is that we've had a go. I'm sure it's not perfect, but that's what the reviewers say. They would give it to pupils as a book to, say, to humanities pupils who think that science is not for them, is some technical geeky thing and is not really human, doesn't have a long history. This is a book they would give to humanities students to open their eyes to the long human history, the deep cultural history of science. We wanted to hit that right as well. Because if we don't, we're not achieving the goal. And I think the litmus test of the way to wisdom is that everyone will say, "Ooh, I want more of that." You see, when St. Paul says, we're in the business of healing broken relationships, people will say, "Ooh, we want more of that." Why? Because everyone has broken relationships. We all know what that means. We've all messed up friendships and marriages and families and, you know, goodness knows what and everything. We've all messed up that. We all know we've got to heal broken relationships. So that's why I think it's so wonderful. Paul, very good at it. So we've got to recover. We've got to recover that. And so and of course we do it by telling the truth. See, the truth is that science has developed, as we know it now, through and within and supported by a Christian worldview. Dave and I are a little bit salty. Sometimes we say, look, we actually making the case. We think that actually, not only is it at least neutral. That in fact, both historically and currently, it doesn't. I mean, some people will say that being religious harms science. Okay, they say it holds science back. Well, that's a false narrative. You can easily knock that one away. But even today, we say, actually, there are all sorts of ways in which being a Christian actually helps you be a scientist. Well, here's one. When you're a scientist, one of the hardest things you've got to do is to completely change your mind about something. It's the most painful experience, but you've got to do it. You've believed in this lovely theory. It's your precious PhD thesis or whatever. It was the thing you were so proud of, and this darn American has done this fabulous experiment that tells you that you were telling a load of nonsense. Now, but of course, if you hadn't had the theory, the American wouldn't have done the lovely experiment. We wouldn't have learnt things. So, you know, you've been wrong in a constructive way, but you're wrong. You've got to turn your mind. Now, the point is, if you've made the biggest turnabout that anyone can ever do, which we call Christian conversion, I mean, it's a huge, huge turnabout. Rather than living for yourself, you live for everybody else. You live for God. I mean, it's a big change of mind. It's a great training ground. And once you've done that, it's much easier to drop your precious thesis. Anyway, so I'm throwing stuff out, but there are other people who want to talk about things, but it's a great question.
Can I just say that I think one of the reasons Christians in Science is so important as an organisation is to have professional scientists who are able to articulate these things. Mm. Because one of the points that Keith Ward made to me after when he came in the autumn, he said, the problem is whenever I talk, and fluent and brilliant as he is, people say, well, you're not a proper scientist.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it is so important to have people who have, in a sense, prove themselves in science to be able to articulate the Christian faith and its history and so on in an articulate manner.
And I can report the Royal Society is much better now than it was for poor old Michael Rees, who's doing very well, by the way.
The response of the Royal Society, though, to that was very, well, of your colleagues was very bad, wasn't it?
Yes.
Any comment on it?
No.
Any other questions? Nigel is a bit over there.
Thank you. You present a very compelling sort of story about the positive relationship between Christianity and science, but is there a danger of pushing the narrative a bit too far towards a sort of rosy view of it? And shouldn't we also include that, you know, the Galileo against the Roman Catholic Church and the problem of orthodoxy against, you know, new ideas and so on? We have to keep that in mind.
Okay, so tell me about the problem of Galileo and the church. So what was the problem
with
Galileo?
I mean, I'm not a scientist. Andrew was a social scientist and background. So I don't know. I mean, from my science at school, it was, you know, Galileo being told he was wrong, he was out of order, being suppressed by the Roman Catholic authorities and so on, and having to recant, and you know,
okay,
that seems to be the narrative.
I'd really like to, it's interesting, isn't it? The Galileo affair is trotted out. I'm not saying you're trotting it out, you're referring to quite the reason you're is trotted out all the time. I really recommend Stephen Collini's book on the Galileo trial, fantastic Cambridge historian of science who's unpicked this now. You see, absolutely, I hear exactly what you're saying, but it isn't as if the debate up till this point is entirely balanced now, is it? Okay, so, you know, if I'm painting a bit of rosy stuff, it isn't as if there are many other people doing it. I mean, the current story is, look at all those scientists the church burnt to death. Yeah, I got it on Twitter. How many did the church burn to death? So, okay, to tell you the answer, it's an easy answer. But it doesn't stop people telling it. You know, the church used to teach the earth was flat, didn't it? Nope. Never. Ever. Galileo was persecuted by the church, wasn't he? It's a Christians versus science. Well, you see, that is a retro projection. Now, of course, the church putting Galileo under house arrest and demanding him to recant was a terrible thing to do. Completely agreed. The church has made big mistakes in dealing with lots of things. Was the Galileo affair, is it appropriate to analyze the Galileo affair as a conflict between Christianity and science? Absolutely not. Ridiculous analysis. Why? Well, because every single actor in that process was a Christian from beginning to end, right? Yeah, the church and others. Copernicus, of course. Oh, got into a lot of trouble. What happened to his publication, De Revolutionibus, when it came out in 1543? Does anyone know? The answer is it went through the papal imprimatur without touching the sides. In fact, the Pope's right-hand cardinal begged Copernicus to publish as soon as he could this wonderful stuff because it was all to the glory of God. Galileo and Cardinal Bellarmine, who became Pope Urban VIII, were the most appalling alpha male egos you ever saw in your life. Read the history. There's a serious clash of big boys going on here. I mean, Galileo was an obnoxious character. He never gave any credit to Kepler, for example. Didn't mention the guy who was the real genius. You see, you've pressed a little button on me here. So the Galileo affair is fascinating, but it is not a clash of Christianity and science. It's a scientific debate held in a social context where there are all sorts of interesting pressures on different people. Pope Urban VIII was one of the biggest pro-science popes. Everyone thought it was going to be fine. Everyone thought that Galileo would be fine under Pope Urban VIII. So why he cast his former friend the Pope as the stupid, dumb Simplicius on the world system and put the ridiculous words into the Pope's mouth, what's the guy to do? And Galileo's chief argument in support, I'll say one more thing, I'm just illustrating so you can all go and find out. The chief argument in support of the heliocentric theory that the Earth moves was a theory of the tides that is completely spurious and obviously wrong because it predicts one high tide a day, not two. And most of the arguments recorded in the debate were scientific, not theological. So you see, that particular case study, thank you, it does, of course, tell us that the church did terrible things in science, but actually, the canonical stories are just driveled down to the lowest common denominator. Thank you so much for that question.
One there. Actually, Andrew yes. Briggs, who spoke at our last meeting, in his book, he's got a chapter on that.
Oh, wonderful. Good.
Yeah. It seems that many scientific advances come through intuitive leaps. But then, what about the scientist then has to step back from it and become a Mr. Spock? How does that, is that a very conflict for a human being to have this brainwave and then have to expose it to detach himself from
Oh, yes. Oh, that's a wonderful question. Absolutely.
How do you handle that?
Yes, these are the two halves of the scientific enterprise. And this is precisely this is the book I'm writing at the moment. I'm really excited. No, I'm excited. Oh no! We'll get out of this soon. More coffee in bed, Kate, haven't we? Yes. So this is fascinating, but it is true of science and art. So let me answer this: have you noticed that the thing we call that you've put your finger on it? Absolutely. When we have a chat over coffee about this, the thing we call the scientific method that Karl Popper writes about and so forth is really only the second half of the scientific method. Hypothesis, deduction, experimental, and induction, and refutation, and so forth. It's what we do with our ideas when we've got them. The first half of the scientific process is precisely the one you've so eloquently, much better than me, put your finger on. That it's the inspiration part. You have to suddenly have this vision, this idea. You reinvent the world. John Brooks and John Hedybrook and Jeff Cantor, the Gifford lectures, are called Reconstructing Nature. And one of the ways in which we doing science is in the image of God is because we might not be making a whole universe again, but we are making an image of the universe in our mind. We can't deduce. So when we look at the sky, for example, astronomy is a great illustrator of this. When we look at the sky, we look at a two-dimensional projection of a three-dimensional universe, actually a four-dimensional universe, because we look into the distance, we look back into time. We cannot deduce the structure of cosmology by looking at the sky. We have to recreate the universe in all sorts of different ways, imagine different ways, and then ask which ones agree with the sky we see. That's what the ancient Aristotelian model of the cosmos was trying to do. That's what Copernicus was trying to do. And that's what my friend and colleague Carlos Frank and his people at Durham do with their supercomputer at the Institute of Cosmological Computing. Every week, they restart the universe and compute a new one. And ask, with this much dark matter and that much energy and this number of galaxies, and you know, does it match the galaxy distribution and the number of satellite galaxies and the amount of dark matter, and how's it going? No, start again. So you've got to do all this recreative, imaginative stuff. And scientists are very, very private about it. They don't like talking about where their ideas come. So the reason I'm writing this book is because I want scientists to talk about those inspirational moments. So scientists here, before you go, you can repay me. Well, you can buy the books, but you can repay me by telling me about your favorite moment of inspiration. That's what I like you to do. And I know you find it hard, and I know you find it personal and private. Now, sculptors, painters, poets, they have the other problem. They're quite happy to talk about those moments of inspiration. The muse, you know, the Greek island where the sunset came, and the you know, all that stuff. They're very comfortable about that. What they're less comfortable and much more private about is their analytic stuff, because they have this too. You really talk to a novelist or to a poet or to an artist about the process of producing a work of art. And it's not, okay, got a great idea, slap, here we go. The oil paint gets scraped off the canvas 10 times, 20 times. The poem gets redrafted as many times. Experiments are tried. It fails. We've got to analyze. Why is it failing? Why is it not working? Let's try this color. Let's put the stanzas the other way around. Very few people, it's not often talked about, but there's a workshop phase of creative arts as well. So, but you know, thank you for this question. I will now stop. But you can see that it's not only science, it's both, and that it's a deeply theological, we can think theologically about this process of creation. And it has two phases. It has an imaginative phase and it has a sweated out phase. And that's common to all. I'm not saying that the creativity in science and arts are identical, but one of the reasons that we think they are so disjoint is that artists and scientists have different taboos. And I don't know why. I just observe it. Fantastic.
I'm just wondering, one or two more questions? He's got a train, that's right. He's staying.
So I'm staying the night. I can't go back to York tonight now.
Okay.
Oh, okay, well. Oh, by the way, anyone who's not riveted by this should have absolute permission to go. It's 9 o'clock. Let me say that, all right. Peter.
Can I push back a bit on your link between the sacredness of the cosmos,
yes,
and evil?
Yes.
Because the left-hand bit of the scriptures that you mentioned, Genesis, ends like every other ancient Near Eastern creation story, well, not every, but most, with the creation of a temple.
Mm.
That's what God is doing. He's
in the Genesis 1, absolutely.
In Genesis 1, he's acting like a priest.
Yes.
And he's creating a temple.
Yes.
And it's a sacred temple. Pantheism is a bad thing, we don't want that. But can you speak a little bit about the sacredness of this material world, yes, which the scientist is, and if that's significant for us as Christians?
Right. Yes. Okay. So there's good sacred and bad sacred. So the pagan sacred myth is the one that says the sacred and holy things are the things you do not touch. You do not change. You don't go to the Holy of Holies. The high priest goes in once a year. You don't go there, right? That's what I meant. Those are the associations I meant by the sacred myth. And it's used. I mean, I can give you chapter and verse. I can quote. So we've talked about fracking a bit. So it's very interesting topical issue. It's one of the issues that cause. So I've heard this very much pagan earth worship given as an argument. Even in a sexual way. I mean, you know, sort of rape and assault of the earth, and the earth is sacred, and it's an affront to trespass on this territory. Now, I'm not, you know, again, you understand me. This is not a pro-fracking argument. It's an anti-bad argument. The earth. The earth is sacred, but not in the don't touch case. The earth is sacred in the same way that other human beings are sacred. Other human beings are sacred. It's not because we don't not touch each other. We're sacred. So what do? We engage because we too are sacred. We too are holy. Being sacred is being called. Being holy is being called into a position under God and in the world to bring about healing. That's our holy work. In fact, it's interesting you should mention priesthood. What do priests do? There are good priests and bad priests too. And so while we're talking about holiness, let's talk about priesthood. A bad priest, okay, is a priest who usurps his or her position of responsibility, becomes exploitative, and it does exactly the opposite of what they're supposed to do, which is to reconcile. A priest, a Levitical priest, stands in the gap, yep, and reconciles God and people. So actually, when Angela Tilby, in her 1996 account, as a humanities trained, you know, Cambridge theologian and BBC producer, she writes this account. I can't remember what she calls the book. It's a religion and science book, and she's writing it from a humanities point of view. And she says, scientists are like priests of a modern age. They seem to hold the key of knowledge that is barred, knowledge barred from the rest of us. It's the kept in the dark myth. She's retelling the kept in the dark myth. Now that's, of course, it is a priesthood, but it's a corrupt priesthood. In some sense, I'm saying that her insight is right. Scientists are priests in the same way that we are all priests. We're very bad, aren't we, as evangelicals, if we are from an evangelical background, at rarely listening to St. Peter telling us when we're all priests. We read St. Peter saying we're all priests, and we understand that there are no priests. That's not what he says. He does not say there are no priests. He says priests are everywhere. So if you're uncomfortable with priesthood, it's really bad if you're a Bible-believing Christian, because everybody's a priest. So we're all called to be priestly. That's engaging, intervening between God and something to mend a relationship. So scientists are the priests, but they're the humblest of all priests. They're given the priestly task of interceding between human and nature. That's what we do. That's our priestly calling. So does that say the right sort of holiness? So that's the good sort of holiness. And they do that within the context of holiness. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tom. One thing just to start with, this church was founded by George Muller. So when you get back to Durham, you probably heard of him back there. Now, the question is, I gather that officially the King of Saudi Arabia believes the world is flat. Now, as the Old Testament forms part of the scriptures of the Islamic religion, could you recommend a book, or possibly a portion of a book, that he could read that would satisfy the Islamic religion and prove to him that the world isn't flat?
I have so little comprehension of the worldview entertained by the King of Saudi Arabia that I wouldn't dare give the man a book recommendation. Although, gosh, is he Sunni or Shia? He's Sunni, isn't he? What I would tend to do is to point him in the direction of probably Al-Hazen, some of the great Islamic scientists and philosophers, without whom we would not have Western science. So before the great medieval Renaissance, in the 12th and 13th century, that's when science got going in Europe. It's the 1200s and the 1300s, not the 1600s. The blue touch paper was lit then. Why? Because Spain was reconquered by the Christian North, but in some cases a more gentle way than it could have been. Why don't we go back to the court of King Alphonsus X of Toledo in 1270. There we will find this wise king excited by the rediscovery of Aristotle's physics, his posterior analytics, his optics. The Muslim scholars that he said, no, stay with us, don't go, stay with us, stay with us. The Jewish scholars he's invited, and the Christian scholars he's invited to study in an interfaith dialogue, these new texts. It's why Gerard of Cremona comes back from Toledo to Paris in about 1280, distraught that the boring old professors in Paris are giving the same lectures that they were giving 40 years previously from the same notes. Oh, no, go to Toledo. That's where it's all happening. That's where it's happening. The great translation movement, that's what got Roger Bacon, Alfred the Great, Alfredus Magnus, Robert Grosseteste, all going in the 13th century, writing about rainbows and clouds and optics and that's where, and then Buridan and the 14th century great Paris scholars who started to think about mechanics in a mathematical way. That's when it got going, thanks to the Islamic scholars and philosophers who kept all this great Aristotelian, at least the questions, not necessarily the right answer, but the questions going. Snell's law, written down mathematically with all the trigonometry in the 10th century by Ibn Sa'd. All that richness was being rediscovered. I'd point him to those people.
And I guess, again, the penultimate curiosity book covers a lot of that progression.
It does, that's true, yeah. Give him that, but it's written by Christians, so that won't work. So, yeah, just, but no, I'm no, yes, okay, you could, but there's, but pointing to something old in Islamic in his own tradition, it's all there.
I'm wondering whether we should, you've been going a long time, Tom, and we really are very, very grateful for your wisdom and insight.
Not at all.
So, thank you very much indeed for a wonderful evening.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Thank you. That's for you.
I didn't know whether I was going to remind people about the bookstore.
I've got a few things to say. Thank you so much, Tom. I just felt this growing delight, and I was just very excited. We kind of need a conference about this, don't we? We need to get all the people together and get some ideas going. Just to say, actually, Elizabeth Wolfenden, Elizabeth Wolfenden's a member of our group, and she's actually started writing books for children, which are theologically and scientifically sort of, but we could maybe send you a draft. how exciting is this? So just to say then, so we've obviously got Tom's books at the back. The next talk is in June, and it's here. And it's Ruth Bankovitz who's talking about the wonders of biology. So come for that. So recordings. I've noticed people sort of trying to take photos and stuff. Obviously, you're welcome to. But Roger puts all the recordings on the website. There's a link to his website. And it's got the slides and the audio. Sadly, not Tom's face. And they're basically explaining it, but it's a program.
I can give you the slides, though.
Yeah.
But just so, not the arm waving.
No. Sorry?
Not the arm waving.
No. Which is sad, you know, that's what's been so nice, actually, is seeing you so excited about this. And I'm just getting very excited about it, too. I just felt it's like you've opened the Pandora's box for us, and we're very, very grateful. Another thing. Discussion group. So, a nice Pandora.
In a nice way, okay.
just to say, we have a discussion group, okay? First Friday of every month, and I'm seriously considering, framing something along the lines of what we've been talking about tonight. Other people want to talk about homelessness, and so please contact me if you want to be involved in the discussion group. And that's probably it, so thank you very, very much indeed.
Actually, the last thing that got out from Pandora's box, as you probably know the myth, is hope. So you, that's the truth. Both books are £10, just to £10 notes, very easy. Very good.